Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, there is news today that dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn has died. With that in mind, we want to take a look at the Moscow he leaves behind. Did you know there are more billionaires now in that city than in any in the world? But first, we have a sad update on a story from 2006. You might remember 12-year-old Rakan Hassan, who'd been paralyzed and left an orphan after an accidental shooting by U.S. troops in Iraq in 2005. Rakan was brought to the U.S., here to Boston, by Dr. Larry Ronan of Mass General Hospital. His story was documented by reporter Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe, who traveled to Iraq with Dr. Ronan to bring Rakan here, where he thrived. People wanted to adopt him, but after his treatment, Rakan wanted to go home. Reluctantly, Dr. Ronan and Kevin Cullen brought him back to Mosul and watched him drive off with his remaining family. And they've just learned that a month ago, Rakan's new home was bombed by insurgents. He was killed, two of his siblings seriously injured, and a reporter and a doctor who thought they did the right thing are now wondering, did they? Kevin Cullen joins us now. Kevin, I am so sorry. You and your kids had become close to Rakan. You write that Dr. Larry Ronan is gutted. What questions are you and he asking yourselves?
I think the hardest thing, Robin, is I think we can ask questions for the rest of our lives, and I don't know if we'll ever get any answers. I have to be quite honest. I don't, as I sit here, feel that anything I wrote targeted Rakan. I talked with Larry the other day, and obviously you saw his quotes in the story. He does blame himself. I don't think he should, because there's no doubt in my mind that if Larry Ronan did not get involved in this, Rakan would have died in 2005.
Because as you write, he was sitting in a wheelchair, you know, in his feces in a corner of his house because there was no care for a paralyzed child.
There are no rehabilitative services in Iraq in the best of times, and there certainly wasn't anything in the middle of a war. But, you know, Larry had this, I compared it to a Solomon-like decision. There's no doubt that we could have got Rakan adopted here, you know, and it would have been violating the rules under which we took him out. The visa was for medical treatment. But I guess in the time of war, you can do anything you want. But the whole idea of us, you know, imposing what we think was best for Rakan was just not in the cards. And it was, I think, extremely hard on him because Larry wasn't just his doctor. He loved Rakan.
Yeah.
And he didn't want anything to happen to him.
Well, and so did you, and neither did you. And you say that you've come to the conclusion that, you know, your writing perhaps didn't get him targeted, but you wondered before coming to that conclusion if maybe somebody had read his story online and targeted him. Do you think it was because he got American help?
I don't know. Iraq is just so Byzantine at this level. It doesn't take you much to get killed over there, particularly in Mosul, where there has been an awful lot of al-Qaeda activity. But, you know, who knows? This could be somebody down the street didn't like the fact that, I don't know, Rakan was wearing some of those jerseys we gave him that were
Red
clearly
Sox.
From America. Who knows? And obviously one of the things I really want to do is get back there and hopefully get on the ground and figure out what happened, because we don't know what happened, and that's what's driving us crazier, I think, than anything.
People like Senator Ted Kennedy and Donald Rumsfeld cut red tape to get Rakan here. A Jewish philanthropist, Ray Tai, paid for all of it. There's another child at Children's Hospital here in Boston right now, also recovering from an accidental burning by U.S. troops. And there's an American group, No More Victims, trying to bring these kids to the U.S. Do you think people should have second thoughts about this, at least, you know, in the short term?
No. I mean, the idea of leaving kids to suffer in Iraq when there's medical care to be had here, I think, is crazy. And I got to be honest, that when I was reporting this, there was some American from the military who said, if you write about this kid, the insurgents will kill him. And I said, is there any evidence that this has happened before? And nobody could give me evidence. And I talked to Iraqis of all shades. I talked to Sunnis. I talked to Shia people. I talked to Kurds. And everybody from Iraq gave me the same response that, no, I mean, as bad as the insurgents are, they wouldn't do that to a kid like that. But his family was killed, so the idea that he would be killed purposely because he came to America and got care, that is such a leap I'm not prepared to take.
That's Kevin Cullen, reporter for the Boston Globe, to link to his story and very bittersweet photographs. You can go to our website, here-now.org. Kevin, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, Robin.
Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Nobel Prize-winning author who died yesterday, spent his final years in a Russia he probably had a hard time recognizing. The man who put the world spotlight on Stalin's gulags died in a new Russia, where Marx and Lenin can't compete with Armani and Dior for the hearts and minds of the city's consuming class. So says our next guest, a man who knows Moscow very well. Writer Martin Cruz Smith is best known for his detective novels featuring Moscow investigator Arkady Renko, played here by William Hurt in the 1983 film of the thriller Gorky Park.
What do you want?
Think back. Any idea who took your skates?
I suspect everyone.
So do I.
That was the Moscow of the Soviet Union. But what's it like today? Well, Moscow is now a city that never sleeps, with more billionaires than any other city in the world, and bloodied homeless people living in the shadows of an amazing construction project, including what will soon be the tallest skyscraper in Europe. Martin Cruz Smith explores Moscow and perhaps trolls for material for his books in the August issue of National Geographic magazine. There are also terrific photos by Gerd Ludwig. We'll link you to both at our website. Martin Cruz Smith joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for asking me.
Well, you start your story with an amazing scene of motorcycle racing in Moscow at night. Can you just tell us more about that?
Well, it's a thoroughly unsanctioned gathering, a rally, the sort of thing that we used to throw a chill into the Kremlin. Now it's sort of an exuberant kind of letting go of energy and excitement, but manifestly dangerous and against the law. I was there with the colonel of the police watching this, and I said, where are the police? Why aren't they doing something? And he said, and he pointed them out, and he said, there they are. They can't do anything.
Because why? I mean, what's unleashed this feeling that people can dress up in leather and outfit these motorcycles, many American-made? I mean,
they're incredibly, incredibly tricked out. They're tricked out with sound systems and lights. Some of them are look like stealth bombers.
Right. What has made these people, these Russians who lived under the, you know, the anvil, if you will, of the Soviet Union, what makes them feel they can do this?
Well, I think they feel that they've got money. And they want to show it.
You write, as we said, more billionaires than in any other city in the world, even New York, even L.A., even...
Even so, and some hidden ones, too, I'm sure. They're very good at obscuring themselves, at hiding themselves, unless they want to come out. And then they've got clubs to go to. They've got private airplanes to fly off to Morocco or Greece.
Where did the money come from? Because many might have been under the impression that industry was taken over by the government. Entrepreneurs ended up in jail.
Well, they still can. If the Kremlin decides it wants an industry or decides it wants a company, it will get it. In the meantime, they've made arrangements with men who are manifestly thieves, who have sort of evolved into sort of a Wild West entrepreneurs. But it's come basically out of raw resources, from gas, minerals, and a lot of it pilfered from their countrymen in the form of fraudulent enterprises, banks. It's as if you're playing Monopoly with Attila the Hun.
Well, and with serious weaponry, at least, you know, in the last couple of decades, you write that there was the aluminum war of 10 years ago.
I love it. You don't say life insurance wars, in which life insurance executives were tossed off the top of buildings. But in the aluminum wars and some other, and a good many of other industries, if you can get in there and get a firm hold with a couple of guards and a corrupt judge and a corrupt jury, you can take over almost any company of any size in Russia, if the Kremlin goes along with it.
And as you write, in this aluminum war of 10 years ago, executives were killed left and right. Now the survivors discover that starting a bank is better than robbing one. And it's also by association. The mayor of Moscow's wife is one of those billionaires.
Yes, well, the mayor of Moscow has a very good reputation for getting things done, and one of the people who was best at getting things done was his wife. He always proclaimed that he lived off his salary. Well, her salary was not too mean because it made her a billionaire.
And she got many of the contracts for the new construction.
Some say 20%, some say 10%. But what you've got there is the largest construction site in the world, and not just this incredible Moscow city of the future, But all over Moscow, and it's a 24-hour assault on old Moscow.
Tell us about this new Moscow city. As you write about most of Moscow, you could see it better at night when the cranes and part of the construction were lit up. What is it?
Well, this new construction is a lot of them hotels, but a great many of them residences. The value of a real estate in Moscow has gone from something like $20 a square foot to $475 a square foot. The business world has moved into Russia because it wants that Russian market. It would have been undreamt of 20 years ago.
You write, in Moscow, in the daytime, you see only architecture, but at night you see blazing ambition, in particular in this new construction site that you're talking about. Well, can compare and contrast for us. You first visited Moscow in 1973. You say that at that time the entire population seemed to retire to a crypt as soon as the sun went down, Red Square empty. If you can, just give us a few sentences of
Now it's color. I mean, it's an astonishingly beautiful city, and it's especially so at night. And you've got these wonderful churches and 18th-century buildings, which are beautiful at night. Lushkov, the mayor, is a bit of a magician, sort of an artist, even in the use of light. There's this, you know, spirit of lightness there that was never there before. When I was there back in '73. To smile was a misdemeanor.
Well, and the people, at least as presented to Westerners, were kind of frumpy, or, you know, Boris and Natasha of Rocky and Bullwinkle fame. And now you describe the women especially as all looking like Maria Sharapova, the tennis star.
There's a host of them, and they're remarkably beautiful, and they stalk the streets, and they show up in clubs, and they live to be beautiful and hot and desirable and to displace the wife of the oligarch they're closest to.
Do you think that people have actually, in the last several decades, literally physically changed in Russia?
That's a great question, because it seems that way. It seems that suddenly the women are 6 inches taller and 50 pounds lighter, and they walk in this stalking sort of cheetah-like way. And I ran into a physical anthropologist there, and she was doing a study on whether in one or two generations there had actually been a physical change in Russian women, whether the proportional volume of fat, body fat, had changed in these women. Somehow the men have lagged behind. Somehow the men all look slightly unshaven and slightly shady, except for Maritsev and the tennis player.
Right. Well, where they haven't lagged, as he said, is in business and achievement. And that's changed Russia, at least in your view, profoundly in another way, that it was once pretty much a classless society, but no longer.
There is this curious nostalgia. Now, there are lots of different nostalgias. There's ex-communists, Stalin or someone like Stalin was back in control, and there was some more stability. But to go into a club, let's say a club judges you by the car you drive, and it may be a Bentley, and then you have come out, and you've got a woman who looks like a cheetah on the leash. You come and you go to the VIP lounge. Then you go to the VIP lounge, so that only a couple of you are left. And this shows actually a certain kind of canniness, because it's these few very rich, very aggressive Russian businessmen who meet at this kind of club and actually do more business there than they do at work.
That's Gorky Park author Martin Cruz Smith on Modern Moscow at Night. When we come back, ethnic tensions and the dark side of the new Russia. Also later, Sichuan alligator, Philly cheesesteak egg rolls. Do you think they're going to have those at the Olympics? No. We'll take a look at Americanized Chinese food. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more from novelist Martin Cruz Smith. His novels feature Russian detective Arkady Renko in books like Stalin's Ghost. But today we're talking about his recent trip to Moscow, which he writes about in the August issue of National Geographic. He paints a picture of a city where millionaires are as common as pigeons, where exclusive nightclubs cater to a new class of mega-rich Russian businessmen. Before the break, we were talking about that, and these new Russians have emerged in a cloudburst of petrodollars. And Martin, you write that in the eyes of most Russians, these people are thieves. Their lifestyle is envied but also abhorred. And you say that there is also a demographic time bomb facing Moscow and Russia impacting this, a combination of a declining population and an influx of Tajiks. Tell us, who are they?
Well, they're Central Asians. They're from Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan. And they all come up and they do work for very little because there's no work back home. They're the people who are up there on the top of these towers that they're erecting for damn little and at high risk. And, of course, they are the targets of skinheads, the ultra-nationalists. So It's a regular feature of Moscow life that the Central Asians walk together and do not go into certain parts of the city.
Well, in fact, on one of your night crawls with your guide, who is a detective who tells you at one point he wishes that your main character, Renko, was a little more, you know, down to earth the way, you know, his life actually was. But he's taking you to see, you know, these real parts of Moscow, and you come across a sort of a gang fight between these Russian nationalists and Tajiks.
And it was astonishing because they were on the brink of actually of going to the next step, which was knives. And it was interesting to see sort of something like a Texas Ranger strut that Sasha suddenly put on and waded in there and sort of dismissed them. I think I could have slipped under a car at that point. But Sasha definitely had his roll down. Then on the way back from visiting one of the train stations at this place called Komsomolskaya Square, which is known to the locals as Three Stations, on the way back we ran into a mugging, and Sasha just finessed that one.
Well, that was really fascinating. There were several people watching this mugging. A homeless man who was sort of roughed up by some young people who ran away with a roll of money. There were other people, I think if my memory's correct, there were some security guards watching this. And
oh, yeah, the security guards. They've been hired to guard this one little stall. They have no interest in what's happening 10 inches away because they weren't paid for that.
Well, and you described this homeless population that your friend, you know, took you to, and it was hard to see at first. They sort of were blending into the cement, but a really bandaged and bloody homeless population. I think you write the dedicated alcoholics.
These were almost literally pickled people.
You write that it looked like a tableau out of a war, you know, after a battle scene, like the Civil War or something. Was it markedly different from homeless that you see in other back alleys in other countries?
Yeah, they all had the same rawness, bruises and gray clothing, so much so that they seemed to blend into the cement of the pavement. And so they sort of come to life in an eerie kind of way. They, you know, a lot of them look as if they'd been, first they were monks who had been tossed into a cement mixer and then dropped from a height.
Mm. What do you think that says in total, Martin Cruz Smith, that you have the highest, perhaps it's going to be the highest building in Europe being constructed, you have more billionaires in Moscow than any other city in the world, and you have this really bloodied homeless population. What do you think it's saying?
Well, it's in effect what it's asking, which was put in the air by an American singer, a black blues singer, at the most exclusive Russian club called Yaghilev. And I heard nothing but Russian all night long. It was about 4 in the morning, and this singer got up there and started singing in English, "After all that we've been through, what did you expect us to be like?" And it was a damn good question. You know, it was after all they had not had over so long and suffered so much, and not only for themselves, but during the war for the rest of us, what do we expect them to be like? You know, they're not going to be British, they're not going to be French or German, and they're certainly not going to be us. And they are up, you know, this is their due. They feel this is their moment is coming.
You ask, was this what millions of Russians died for in wars and prison camps? Had they faced down a KGB coup and dismantled an empire so a few gluttons could party through the night?
The thing I like about Russia is that it's constantly, it has been in my lifetime, constantly changing. I never meant to write more than one book about Russia. It started to change, and so I felt, well, I'd do a second. And then some here I am with 6 books gone and this article. And it continues to slip out of my hand. I'd like to say I capture Russia, but I don't. I'm just grabbing and reporting what I see. And in this case, it seems to be sort of, well, it's a nighttime report. Mm-hmm. I had intended to do a wonderful article also about a shelter for abused children in Moscow, and the best I've ever seen anywhere. But I'm afraid it was nighttime. It's night in Moscow, and they were asleep.
Well, the image that I'm left with, it's one of my favorites. You describe how some of the major highways have a road that goes down the middle that was supposed to be just for VIPs, so VIPs could move quickly around the city. And there are so many people who consider themselves VIPs that you say that there's often this, you know, two convoys of VIPs facing each other on the road, because you can go either way on it, on this one road, and, you know, showdown over who's going to stay in that middle VIP lane.
Well, it is such a land right now, braggadocio. It's very machismo. And they don't, you know, the idea is they don't back down for anyone. If someone could just add a little vodka to the situation and light a match, you know, you have the feeling that, you know, half of Moscow would suddenly go for their guns.
Martin Cruz Smith, his latest book is Stalin's Ghost. He writes about Moscow at night in the August issue of National Geographic. We'll link you to the story and photos by Gerd Ludwig at our website, here-now.org. Martin, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot for asking me.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, historian Howard Zinn on the U.S. as empire and a new comic book version of his writing. We'll also speak to an American scientist in Beijing to monitor the air. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the suicide of Bruce Ivins, the alleged suspect in the anthrax murders. His therapist broke her confidentiality with him. Is that legal, ethical, required? I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Federal investigators say a series of sophisticated genetic tests helped them identify the specific batch of anthrax that killed five people across the U.S. in 2001. And with this evidence, that led the FBI to conclude that the deadly anthrax could only have come from Bruce Ivins, a top government research scientist at Fort Detrick in Maryland. Ivins, of course, died in an apparent suicide last week after learning that federal prosecutors were preparing murder charges against him in connection with the anthrax mailings. For more, we turn to Los Angeles Times reporter David Willman, the first to report on the impending indictment against Ivins and then on his subsequent death. And David, you're writing today about these sophisticated tests that federal agents say led them to focus on Bruce Ivins. Tell us more about these genetic tests.
The genetic tests were first performed by the Institute for Genomic Research in Rockville, Maryland. But more recently, investigators believe that significant breakthroughs in the genetic analysis of the anthrax materials has been made by a contractor to the FBI, Ibis Biosciences.
Well, has the government established that only Bruce Ivins had access to this material? Do they draw the line directly to him, or might other scientists working with him at the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases have had access to that same anthrax?
What we've reported is that investigators concluded, based on the time frame within which the batches of spores that Bruce Ivins was using in his government work, and that they believe match up exactly with the admixture that was recovered from anthrax mailings that were sent out in fall 2001, that matching that up through just good old-fashioned gumshoe investigative work, that Bruce Ivins is the most reasonable culprit who could have pulled this off.
Well, there have been reports about Bruce Ivins benefiting from an anthrax scare because he was a co-inventor for some anthrax vaccines. A colleague of his, Dr. Russell Burns, spoke on the Today Show today and said, you know, that was ridiculous. The government really owns the vaccine. But as you report, because of the structure of contracts, he as a co-inventor, could have stood to gain tens of thousands, not millions. But this colleague also said Bruce Ivins, the person, wasn't the man that he's hearing described. Now, we know his former therapist, Gene Dooley, who'd been meeting with Ivins for about 6 months in group therapy sessions and biweekly private sessions, applied for a restraining order against Ivins. She told the judge in a Maryland district court that he came to a group meeting saying that he'd had a gun and had a plan to kill coworkers. After that session, she called police. He was committed to an institution. He was then released and left messages on her phone saying that her seeking a restraining order allowed the FBI to now prosecute him for the anthrax murders, meaning it was her fault. She gave those answering machine tapes to the FBI. Do we know if her testimony is considered part of the circumstantial evidence, or, you know, is the Bruce Ivins that she talks about one who was, you know, under pressure because the glare, the focus of the investigation was on him?
I would look at it this way. I think you have to apply the chicken and the egg principle here. When the pressure was reaching a fever pitch on Bruce Ivins, he obviously was behaving in a very troubling manner. I think it would be misleading to assume that his statements under that pressure to this therapist were material in pushing the pending charges of murder against him.
That's Los Angeles Times reporter David Willman. Well, what about Bruce Ivan's relationship with his therapist? Why are we hearing so much about it? Aren't there confidentiality laws? Dr. Paul Applebaum is a professor of psychiatry at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. Dr. Applebaum, what are the laws regarding confidentiality? Because some people have been shocked to hear a therapist's words about her patient.
Well, therapists in general are bound by their ethical codes to maintain the confidences of patients that are revealed during treatment sessions. There are some exceptions, however, and one of those exceptions is when a patient makes a threat against third parties that seems likely to be acted on.
And what about a death? Do all confidentiality concerns or requirements go out the window if someone has died? Does that liberate therapists?
Most mental health professions, as part of their ethical codes, specify that the ethical obligations of a therapist to a patient don't cease at the patient's death. Were that not the case, prominent people and just ordinary people who simply didn't want the private information that they discussed in therapy to be revealed after their death might decide never to come to therapy in the first place.
Well, this therapist in question did call police after Bruce Ivins said he had a plan to kill coworkers. That's when he was picked up and committed. You know, conversely, would she have been legally responsible had she not reported that?
Well, in general, therapists can be held legally responsible if they should be aware that their patients are likely to harm other people. The legal liability is to the victims or the survivors of the victims, who can then sue, alleging that the therapist should have done something to prevent the terrible outcome that occurred.
Well, you point out that therapists could be held responsible and that they could be, you know, the subject of a malpractice claim or a lawsuit. But legally, we understand some states absolutely require them to report to the police if, in fact, someone has named a potential victim. What are some of the other state requirements of therapists?
In those states that impose specific requirements, they tend to come into four categories: either voluntarily hospitalizing the patient, involuntarily hospitalizing the patient, warning the victim, or warning the police. And as a matter of law in many of those states, if you do one of those things as a therapist, you've discharged your obligation. Mm-hmm. Some states, like Massachusetts and Indiana, will require you to do more than one, may require you to do two or three of them.
In other words, hospitalize the patient, notify the victim, and notify the police.
That's right.
Three. This is a slippery slope for therapists because we understand that in some cases, what might be actually best and most preventive is continued therapy. And, you know, losing the trust of the patient, you discontinue the therapy.
It is a very difficult balance to hit because sometimes the worst thing you can do is to breach confidentiality and drive the patient away from therapy. It may be precisely the therapy that's keeping the patient from acting out on his or her violent impulses. And so only when it is substantially likely that someone is going to be harmed by the patient should therapists break that confidentiality. And before they do that, they should, whenever possible, be trying to do everything else short of breaching confidentiality to try to make sure that that harm will not occur.
Dr. Paul Applebaum, professor of psychiatry at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, thank you so much for speaking to us, Professor.
My pleasure.
All right, before we go today, we're going to take a world tour of Chinese restaurants with Jennifer 8 Lee. Yes, 8, the number is her middle name, we'll explain. And she found salt and pepper frog legs in France, steak and cheese egg rolls in Philly. And did you know a fortune cookie got its start, not in China, but in Japan? That's later today. You're listening to Here and Now. Last month at a Protestant church here in Boston, three women were ordained as Roman Catholic priests. Now, the Vatican has said that the ordination of women is forbidden under church law. Women can't be priests because Jesus did not have female apostles, and that any women taking part in ordination ceremonies, such as last month's, face excommunication. Well, the three women say they were ordained as Roman Catholic priests, and they're now serving communities in Florida, Maryland, and New York. Around the country, 31 women now say they are Catholic priests. Here now is Fred Tice, went to a Mass at St. Mary Magdala's Chapel in Harwichport, Massachusetts, to find out why some Catholics are drawn to a service led by a woman.
Marie David said she always wanted to be a priest, and in 2005, she ignored all the warnings about automatic excommunication from the Catholic Church and took part in an ordination ceremony. David says she understands the contradiction between her own desire to serve as a Catholic priest and the Vatican's prohibition on women priests.
But when I die, I don't want to say, well, they wouldn't let me do it. I want to approach God and say, this is what I did, and this is why I did it.
In Boston, a spokesman for the Archdiocese recently made it clear that women cannot be Catholic priests. And in a recent statement, the Archdiocese said the women who claim to be priests have excommunicated themselves by their actions. Still, David cheerfully welcomes worshipers every Sunday morning to a small chapel in Harwichport. David also challenges another convention about priests. She's married. She and her husband own the chapel behind their bed and breakfast. For the most part, David delivers your basic Catholic service, with some differences.
Let us continue our prayer in the name of our God, who is Mother, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
In a standard Catholic service, the priest does not ask for feedback after delivering the homily, but David invites the congregation to share their thoughts, and they oblige. The day's topic is fear.
I think fear comes from our feeling responsible for everything and that we need to make sure everybody's okay. But the more I let God take over and trust God to take care of things, it's so much easier.
The community announcements are also full of give and take. When one of the parents announces that her son is about to have a birthday, the whole congregation joins to wish him a happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you.
And how old are you going to be?
Six. Wonderful. Have a great day.
Typically, several dozen people show up, representing a wide range of ages. There are families with children, and there are gray hairs. They come because they want a Catholic Mass, but no longer feel at home in the Catholic Church. Anne O'Callaghan says her church has let her down.
Everything, and I just got so disappointed, especially with the handling of this, the sex abuse. And finally, I just couldn't go to church and listen to dribble. So we read about Marie in the local paper. We had moved down here, and I said, well, let's give it a try. We haven't gone to church in a year, so how bad can it be? And it was like coming home. It did not feel strange to see a woman priest. It shouldn't matter what sex you are to worship God.
Carol Mitchell says she used to feel lonely in the church, but here she says she feels close to everyone else, and the fact that the priest is a woman is a bonus.
What we're looking for in a priest is compassion, an intellect, and a modeling of our devotion to the Lord. We can find that in either man or woman. Our women priests are perhaps modeling a closer walk with God because we're suffering the excommunication from the church that we love.
While it's only David who is excommunicated, worshipers do feel that they're fighting this battle with her.
Loving God, our mother and father, hear these prayers and give us the courage to live responsibly in all the areas of our lives.
David believes she's living responsibly by challenging the church, and her small congregation seems happy to join her.
Here now is Fred Tice. And in the moment, we have some of the stories in the works here at Here and Now. Why does former Bush speechwriter David Frum say political conventions have been ruined by television? They need an overhaul. Also, why Beijing was the place to be ahead of New York and Paris even before the upcoming Olympics. Speaking of which, coming up, Jennifer Ait Lee on eating Chinese food in America. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. New York Times reporter Jennifer Lee's middle name is 8. Not the word, the number. As many of us are learning, 8 means prosperity for the Chinese, hence the Olympics launch at 8 p.m. on 8808. Well, Americans are also learning about Chinese cuisine and finding out that their neighborhood Chinese restaurant may have little to do with it. Jennifer 8 Lee, the American-born daughter of Chinese immigrants, spent over 2 years researching Chinese restaurants around the world, and the result is her book, The Fortune Cookie Chronicles, Adventures in the World of Chinese Food. Here now's Emiko Tamagawa caught up with Lee here in Boston. They met, at Jenny's request, at Zoe's Gourmet Chinese in Somerville, Massachusetts, because it met many of Jenny's criteria for a true Chinese restaurant.
If they give you chopsticks instead of forks, that's key. Chinese on the menu. If they don't charge you for rice or tea, other things that if you just look at the menu, you can tell. Like, you know, do they have jellyfish? Do they have things like lamb? Do they have duck's feet? You know, cold appetizers. That's a good way, actually, to tell whether or not it's a Chinese restaurant for Chinese people.
Well, General Tso's chicken, that deep-fried, spicy, sweet dish, is not a good indicator. According to Jenny, it was pretty much invented in the U.S., but she says it can still pass for Chinese food.
One of the points of my book is that authenticity is a function of time and place. That, yes, you know, it's not, quote, authentic Chinese food, but it is authentic Chinese-American food, in that a lot of Americans see this dish, and to them it represents a taste of home and a sense of memory. After the U.S. invaded Iraq, there were two Chinese restaurants that sprung up in the Green Zone that were immensely popular among Americans. And I asked, why are they so popular? My friend was like, well, it's a taste of home. What could be more American than a takeout and a beer?
Over the past couple of years, how many restaurants would you say you've eaten in Chinese restaurants and American Chinese restaurants?
In total, I probably have been to 150 to 200 Chinese restaurants on 6 continents and 42 states. In the United States, there are more Chinese restaurants than McDonald's, Burger King, and Kentucky Fried Chickens combined. There are 40,000 in the United States. Chinese food is served on all 7 continents, even Antarctica, because Monday night is Chinese food night at McMurdo Station, the main station in Antarctica. And there's also Chinese food in space, because NASA serves sweet and sour pork that's thermostabilized.
One thing that comes out time and time again as you go to various places is how adaptable Chinese cuisine is.
Yeah, it's more a philosophy than a set of ingredients. So, you know, you can go to Philadelphia and you get the Philly cheesesteak roll, which looks like an egg roll on the outside and it's Philly cheesesteak inside. Or you can go to New Orleans area and you get sweet and sour crawfish and Sichuan alligator. Or you can go to France and get salt and pepper frog legs, because that's what they eat in France.
But also, this idea that I've always wondered about is how Chinese restaurants manage to pop up in the middle of nowhere, including places where there is no Chinese community.
What actually happens is that people oftentimes go out looking for small towns where there are not already Chinese restaurants. So over time, these restaurants have gotten to be in smaller and smaller towns. So basically, you can support a Chinese restaurant in a town that's less than 1,000 people. What's interesting also is that of the buying and selling of Chinese restaurants, there are some people who just go out and serially start Chinese restaurants, and then they sell them to Chinese families who, you know, show up and run a Chinese restaurant, whether or not they have previous experience running a Chinese restaurant.
You know, we've been talking so much, I'm thinking we should probably order at some point.
What do you want to eat? Are you vegetarian? I hope
you're
not.
The one thing that sounded fascinating was the lamb. But,
okay, yeah, no, the lamb with cumin and spicy sauce, that's actually really good. And then maybe Mao's homestyle pork.
Hi.
Okay. Mao jia hong sao lou. Okay. Feng shao xie zi.
So I suppose we do have to talk a little bit about fortune cookies, because the book starts from the fact that a whole bunch of people won Powerball.
Yeah, they had 110 second-place winners instead of the 3 or 4 winners they expected, and when they investigated, it turned out that many of those people had played lucky numbers from a fortune cookie, and I track this fortune cookie Powerball number back to a fortune cookie factory in Long Island City in Queens, New York City.
You also trace the fortune cookie itself. And the thing that surprised me is where you finally ended up.
Yeah, I traced the history of the fortune cookie back from America to Japan. Outside Kyoto, there are still small family-run bakeries that are making fortune cookies by hand. Of course, their fortune cookies are brown because they're flavored with miso and sesame instead of with butter and vanilla. And there was also a drawing from around the late 1800s of a man making fortune cookies decades before there's been any mention of fortune cookies in the United States.
One thing that you also point out is the idea of when fortune cookies changed from being a Japanese bakery thing to being a Chinese bakery thing, and that was very interesting.
Yeah. Fortune cookies basically make a transition around the time of World War II, and as I went back and talked to a bunch of the Japanese bakering families, they all mentioned, well, we were all locked up during World War II, so their bakery shut down and took them many years to kind of gear up again. There was also a large demand and surge for fortune cookies because a lot of the soldiers going in and out of San Francisco during World War II encountered these cookies and wanted them when they went back home to Iowa and Minnesota. So there was a spike in demand for fortune cookies across the country, and the Chinese moved in to make them. So in the end, the fortune cookie is something that was introduced by the Japanese, popularized by the Chinese, and ultimately consumed by Americans.
That took an amazingly short amount of time.
Especially for that dish, because that dish looks actually like it took some time to cook. But sometimes you wonder if they just like are psychic, behind the door, and they know what you're going to order before you do. And so it's shocking sometimes how quickly Chinese restaurants kind of introduce the food. And this is actually the speed by which Chinese restaurants cook is actually one of the reasons I'm sure they become so popular. Because, you can get the food cheaply, reliably, very quickly, in plentiful quantities at a good price.
A lot of your book is light, and it's fun, and it talks about different, fortune cookies and this and that. But the two things that you bring up that are very serious are the sort of hazards that the delivery people go through, like physically in danger. And also, let's be honest, where a lot of these workers come from, the fact that a lot of them are illegal.
The going rate for being smuggled to America right now is about $74,000. And the hazards that some of these people have taken to sort of deliver your general's house chicken to your door is sort of astounding. Like, there was this one guy I profile that walked 30 days in the jungles of Burma and stayed in Thailand before getting on a very rickety boat that went from Thailand around the coast of Africa to the United States. And then he spent 4 years basically in federal confinement. Now he actually owns a restaurant in Dublin, Ohio for 150 people. So I asked him, is this all worth it? And he really hesitated. He said if he knew then what he knew now, he probably wouldn't have taken the risk. But it ultimately wasn't about him. It was about serving his parents and, helping his children. The other point that you make, right, okay, is about Chinese restaurant workers. So in New York City and in many urban areas, Chinese restaurant workers are killed or attacked with alarming frequency. Like within New York City in the last decade alone, I would say there are 6 or 7 delivery workers that have been shot, oftentimes for as little as $12 or an order of General's House Chicken.
Part of your exploration to Chinese restaurants felt like it was an exploration to your past, too.
As I started the research, I was completely obsessed with Chinese restaurants, and I couldn't really figure out why. And my editor was like, you need to figure out why you're so obsessed with Chinese food. And 3 years, 6 continents, and 42 states later, I realized that the story about Chinese restaurants was ultimately also the story about myself, that in understanding how can something both be exotic and indigenous to America. Because General's House Chicken, most people think of it as something that's foreign, but in fact, it exists primarily in America. In a way, you can see me and you can see someone who's Chinese, but if you close your eyes or just listen to me, you know that I'm clearly someone who's American. And that duality I explore not only in Chinese food, but also in myself.
That's Jennifer Eight Lee speaking to Here Now's Emiko Tamagawa. For more about the Fortune Cookie Chronicles, go to our website, here-now.org.
What's next?
Fortune cookies.
Do you still get excited about opening?
I do. You know why? This is why I get excited, because I know so much about fortune cookies that I can look at a piece of paper generally, and 80% of the time I can tell you where the fortune cookie piece of paper came from. So I'll read mine. Oh, you find beauty in ordinary things. Do not lose this ability.
Confucius say, lovers in triangle, not on square.
That's really weird. That's a weird one, actually.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.